not only profoundly disturbing, that video of the shooting death of an unarmed black man by a white police officer in South Carolina highlights, in the way no other narrative form could, a phenomenon that African Americans have been complaining about for years, and most intensely in the past year. This latest story clearly demonstrates the power of citizens and their cell phones to document the use of excessive force by police, influence criminal justice, and public opinion. We'll talk about the death of Walter Scott with Midday contributor Sherry Parks in the next hour of the show. Also on Sherry's mind, the backlash against religious freedom laws in Indiana and Arkansas, and what we think about when we think about poverty. Midday on American Culture with Sherry Parks, after the news. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Joined in this hour by Sherry Parks, Associate Dean in Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park and a contributor to Midday. Sherry, nice to have you on the show again.
Nice to be here.
Three things on your mind this week that we're going to talk about. One has to do with poverty and a disturbing story that we read about the long-term effects of childhood poverty. We'll get to that during this hour. Another thing worth talking about, because it was stunning to me and to many other people, the backlash to those religious freedom laws, some would call them gay discrimination laws, passed by legislatures in Arkansas and in Indiana. But fresh in our minds is the gravely disturbing story captured on video of the shooting death of a man named Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina. That video highlights, I think, in a way no eyewitness or journalistic account could, this phenomenon that African Americans have been complaining about for years, and most intensely in the past year, joined by lots of the rest of us, whites and browns and everybody, very concerned about what's happening on our streets between police and minorities. This latest story clearly demonstrates, for one thing, the power of citizens and their cell phones to document the use of excessive force by police and influence criminal justice and public opinion in this case. So I got to first start off by saying how stunned I was by this video, even though we think we've seen this before. I don't know that I have seen this before, actual shooting of a fleeing man, a man running away from a white police officer, a black man running away from a white police officer being shot in the back. I've watched episodes of Cops. I've seen documentaries. I've seen cell phone video, news video, but I don't remember actually.
Yeah. I mean, the real thing is much more poignant than
and hearing the gunshots.
Unfortunately, I have. There's a new documentary, Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Our Youth Movement by Ralph Crowder, that has gathered several of these incidents caught, again, on cell phones. So I've seen a number of them.
I think I want to see that. Hands Up, Don't Shoot. I've heard about it, but I haven't seen it.
Don't Shoot, Our Youth Movement.
Okay. What do we want to say about this? I wanted to talk a little bit about the role of the citizen and the camera, which is huge in this story to me. I mean, I'm not sure we would be talking about this today if it wasn't for that video, but we can argue that.
One of the things, I mean, and in one of your tweets, you actually had a link to a New York Times article with the apps that make it easy to do this. Yeah. One of the things that I was surprised to see, and we now know the guy who shot the video's name, he's come forward, Feldon Santana, right, who was just walking on his way to work, is how steady the video is. I mean, it looks almost professionally done. I don't know if I was filming that, whether I wouldn't have moaned or cried or moved in some way, but he has a very steady hand, which suggests in a way he wasn't so shocked by it. I thought that was particularly telling.
Yes, and he does. You hear his voice eventually in the video when he realizes that Mr. Scott is probably dead, mm-hmm, right? But otherwise, he's quiet through.
And still.
Almost like you say, almost a professional approach to it. By the way, Sherry, I have it as this is a CNN story from MSNBC and NBC. His first name, Feiden? It looks like Feidin Santana. So I don't know how you pronounce that. Feiden Santana. He's the man who recorded this South Carolina police officer shooting Mr. Scott. He says he fears for his own life, and that almost kept him from revealing the tape. I wonder how others felt about this as you were watching that video. Please join Sherry and I for this discussion, 410-662-8780.
And I think there's a larger point I want to make while we're waiting for people to start lining up. The rapidity of the firing, I think, is really interesting because this is an officer who had in 2013 another excessive force complaint. The person didn't die, but he pushed his way into a house in which there was no crime. Hmm. He said there was, and he stunned the guy because the guy didn't open the door fast enough. Nothing was done. But what I thought when I saw the press conference, when they said that he had been fired and that he was being charged with murder, very quickly, as soon as they saw the videotape, that was a practice response, that because we've seen so many incidents of unarmed black men, that police chief didn't have to spend days thinking about what he was going to do. I think the other difference that's occurring is that there, when you talk about social change, because as you pointed out, black people have, our social reality has not changed. We've known about this for decades, unfortunately. It was the rest of the country who didn't have this perception, often because there were no charges, nothing happened. Now there is a shift occurring where ordinary people who are not African-American, one, know about this and have shamed it, so that you can move very quickly. That police chief in South Carolina didn't have to say, well, I wonder what the community will think about me if I do this. And in previous years, he might have. And so what happens with social change is not just that I change, it's that I know that the consensus of the community has changed, so that I can then act differently, knowing that I'm safe in doing that. That's when you get social change. And I think that's the moment we're in.
You could move that theme over to another part of our show today when we talk about the religious freedom laws and the backlash to that. Those corporations that came out and criticized the state of Indiana, the governors of Indiana and Arkansas for that, you know, maybe 10 years ago they wouldn't have done
that. But the polls have shifted.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, interesting commentary on this story from South Carolina. This one from David Graham writing in The Atlantic. The shockingly familiar killing of Walter Scott. But listen to what he says. He says, Walter Scott's killing is unusual in several ways. It's unusual that a traffic stop ended in death. It's unusual and decisive that it was caught on film. And it's highly unusual that it has produced a murder charge against a police officer.
That's the highly unusual part.
Yeah. But in other ways, he says, the incident seems depressingly familiar. Scott was stopped for having a taillight out, the sort of minimal issue that advocates say is often used as a pretext to harass black citizens and to search for other violations.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think here we also have to talk about what happens in black people's minds. The fact that it may indeed be statistically rare for a taillight incident to lead to death, but black people have to live in fear every time they're stopped by a policeman. So they've imagined and practiced and prepared their sons for it over and over.
You know, that's another comment I wanted to mention. I've heard people say, well, he shouldn't have resisted arrest. He shouldn't have run away from the officer. He shouldn't have been this. He shouldn't have been that, right? David Graham, again, from his piece in The Atlantic, an encounter with the police is generally stressful. It's especially difficult when black citizens are wary of the police and feel unfairly targeted. So you have to take that into account.
If you know that you could die, what would you do in that moment? I mean, it may be the most reasonable thing in the world to try to get away.
Yeah. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here if you'd like to comment on this story from South Carolina. The one thing I wanted to say about social change, the comment you were making before, I got to go back to the video because I'm not sure, still not sure, that without the video we have much of a story here. Now, an officer shot a fleeing man from behind in his back 8 times. So you might say, well, that's extraordinary. Some coroner is going to look at that, a medical examiner, and some district attorney is going to look at that. That officer is in trouble even without a video. I say maybe. We had a case in Baltimore City, 2000, I'm trying to remember what year this was, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe a little longer now, where an officer shot a fleeing man who was unarmed and stood trial. He was charged with, I think, manslaughter it was, and he was found not guilty by a jury, shooting an unarmed man from behind.
Well, and remember,
I'm just saying, if you don't have the video, I'm not sure you have a...
I agree with you, because remember the policeman lied. He said Walter Scott was 50 years old. The policeman said he was mid-20s to 30, and that he was in fear of his own life, and that Walter Scott had, when he called the dispatcher, that he had
his taser.
Yeah. Well, we know that the only reason that the taser was near Walter Scott is that the policeman walked up and put it beside Walter Scott. And if he was in fear of a person who was running away from him, now let's assume that he's right, that he was afraid. That means that this policeman was so panicked about black men that he's afraid even when they're moving away from him.
410-662-8780 is our phone number if you'd like to join us for commentary on this with Sherry Parks. Our email address for Midday is midday@wypr.org. Now, going back again to the video, and this is a different world we're living in now. Citizens, police have guns, criminals have guns, citizens have cameras, too, in their hands at their disposal. And I really think it's a chicken and egg thing, Sherry. Which comes first, the social change you're talking about or the videos? I think the videos are very powerful pushing people.
I agree with you. Yeah. I think, well, I would put it kind of in the middle. First of all, you have to have some people who are early adapters to video, who are worried about police brutality, who then do the video. And then you have the shift, because we then witness it along with these other people. There have been witnesses to these crimes before. They're still worn out. Not indictments.
Right. Many officers never even charged.
Right.
In fact, that is a rare thing. We're going to take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more with Sherry Parks. A couple other things we want to talk about during this hour of the show. We have some new information, a study on children in poverty and the actual effects of poverty on their brain development of kids.
Yes.
And then we're going to go to Indiana and Arkansas and talk a little bit about those religious freedom laws. If you'd like to join us again, 410-662-8780, the backlash to them. And also, what's coming up in the Supreme Court later this month is connected to that story. So a short break here on Midday. We'll be right back with Sherry Parks. And welcome back. Dan Rodericks here with Sherry Parks. Sherry joins us once a month to talk about American culture. 410-662-8780. American culture. Americans armed with cameras on the lookout for incidents like this one in South Carolina that resulted in the death of Walter Scott. And I'm just catching up on Faden Santana, the man who shot this video. So I was interested to hear what he had to say. He was on MSNBC with Chris Hayes. I guess, did Lester Holt also interview him on NBC?
I saw that, yes.
Okay. He said, I thought about erasing the video. I felt that my life with this information might be in danger. I know the cop didn't do the right thing, and like I say, I feel kind of scared about that. The cell phone video reignited national outcry surrounding police treatment of African Americans and led to a murder charge against the officer, Slager, Michael Slager, who is white. He's also been fired from the police force. And, of course, Walter Scott was black. Let's see. Santana is 23 years old, told MSNBC and NBC that he didn't see Scott grab the officer's taser. He said he ultimately revealed the video because what he saw, a police officer shooting a man who was running away, didn't match initial reports of the incident. And yeah, right, because this happened on Saturday, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As you can see in the video, the police officer just shot him in the back, and I knew right away that I had something in my hands. Yeah.
Well, I understand his fear. I mean, have you traveled to Charleston before? This is just outside of Charleston in South Carolina. I grew up in North Carolina. I mean, the backlash.
I have a different perspective of traveling around in the South than you do.
Well,
I mean, I don't remember feeling anything in South Carolina.
I
in
wonder
Charleston,
why.
Other than right. No, I mean, that's the difference.
The
isn't
Confederate
it?
Flag is still flying.
Well, it makes me uncomfortable. What am I going to do? Go challenge a guy in a pickup truck saying, you know, that's really obnoxious.
But
you know,
for Santana, the guy in the pickup truck could be dangerous.
Yeah. I get that. Yeah. I get that. 410-662-8780. Let's take a couple of calls on this subject before we move on to the other things we want to cover in this hour. And actually, you can call on at any time if there's something you want to say about this case in South Carolina. Dwight in Baltimore. Hello. Welcome to the show.
Well, how are you?
Okay.
My 2 points. One, about the cell phones. They are working, different smartphones. They are working in our favor as well as working against us. I think against us, because I do believe the mindset is being dictated what's on those phones, the video games and all that stuff. And so, ironically, the Bell cell phone helps us this time. And I think also for our people across the board, everyone, it works against us as far as violence and stuff in our community. Two, the second point.
I'm not sure, Dwight, before you move on, I want to make sure I understand the first point. I'm not quite sure I understand. What's the downside of that, please?
Well, the culture nowadays, we have all these smartphones, and everybody's playing these video games. They're shooting each other. We're desensitized by violence and stuff
like
that.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, I just need a little more on that. Thank you very much, Dwight.
Right. Yeah.
And to fill in a little bit, his point is that it might not have been immediately obvious because black kids and black families often skip having a PC in their house, and so they use their smartphones as their PCs, so they're playing video games on their phones.
Okay.
My other point is that in the sequence of events, we see that video. There's also an African-American policeman there. After the shooting, that African-American policeman comes on site. He walks away. The white policeman, he walks away, goes against the taser and comes back and plants it. Now, I would think, I'm not sure about protocols, but I would think that the black cop writes a report, too, and it was interesting what report did he write. You have two policemen on scene there.
Yeah, Dwight, I was thinking the same thing. What's going on in the mind of the other officer who arrives and he's put on his medical gloves for a moment, right? His rubber gloves, latex gloves, and I think realizes that Mr. Scott is dead. If they both didn't realize it right away. But did you wonder the same thing?
What
was this other officer thinking about what had just happened?
And, of course, we don't know what he's thinking. I don't think his report has been released. I haven't seen it. There have been other instances where the black policeman has to choose between which culture he's belonging to, whether it's the police culture or African-American culture. And some, and including here in Baltimore, have chosen the police culture.
Mm-hmm. You know that case I talked about earlier where the Baltimore officer shot a fleeing man? This was in a shopping center, Hamilton Park Shopping Center. The officer was black, and the man who was shot was black. There wasn't an uproar at the time. And, of course, your instinct is to say, well, it's because the officer was black. No, it's because I talked to Doc Cheatham, who was then, I think, president of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP. He said at the time we weren't as primed on this at the time. There wasn't as much social media at the time. It didn't get that kind of buzz. The organizations that existed at the time just didn't respond, didn't react to that. There was a vigil. There was some kind of candlelight vigil over it. This goes back a few years now. I wish I remembered the exact year because I wrote a story about it. I just can't remember the year. But it was a while ago. It was like 2009 maybe or 2008. And he said there just wasn't the vigilance at the time, that people weren't primed to respond that way.
If
it was a white officer, that maybe there would have been a different reaction.
Maybe. And there's a piece of that because the media are playing a role here. Now it's a media theme.
Oh, yeah.
So every time, things that they wouldn't have reported before, certainly reported in other cities, now every time an unarmed black man is shot, it ends up on the media.
That's true.
Which heightens our perception.
In my case, the one I'm talking about, it actually did go to trial. Mm. So with that alone made it unusual and newsworthy and it got more press than other cases, but he was acquitted.
Yeah.
That officer was acquitted. Rhonda, you're on Midday Next. Thank you very much. It was 2008 that case happened. Rhonda, thank you very much
Hello.
For calling.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
This problem is so old and it's so sad because when I was young, a lot younger, you know, there was a case in Baltimore, the Juwan McGee case. I don't know.
Oh, I remember that name.
Many people even remember that.
Yeah, I remember Juwan McGee.
A 12-year-old boy went to get a pizza for his mother, and he was standing at the pizza shop at the counter. And then off duty, he pulled something out of his pocket. It might have been a lighter or something. And he was shot in the back by an off-duty cop for no reason.
Well, the officer, the officer
from
thought,
the waist down.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was an outrage. And, there was a committee, and luckily, at least there was a police in-house, hearing, and he was disciplined, but then a short time after the fury died down, the police officer was put back on duty.
Let me just make one distinction.
I also want to bring
Rhonda, I'm talking now. My turn. I just want to make one distinction there. That was a very tragic case with an officer overreacting, or reacting too quickly, responding too quickly. But there was a question about whether the boy, what the boy was pulling out of his jacket. I think Rhonda's right. It turned out to be a cigarette lighter. It wasn't like he was running away. He was shot from behind from 20 feet away. So, I mean, I don't know. The distinction, I think that the distinction is worth noting here. It's, to me, a different set of circumstances.
Well, although, I don't know, I'm kind of between you and Rhonda in that it is dangerous for a black man to put his hand in his pocket. And in the article about the apps, they created an app so that black men could themselves film, and they found that that increased the danger for black men because they can't touch their pockets.
Listen, I'm with you. I'm not defending what I think it was officer. Yeah. I can't remember the officer's name. I'm not defending what he did. I'm just saying this was an instant moment when he thought this guy, the young guy, was drawing. I don't know if he was 12 years old. I forget how old Juwan McGee was. I thought he was a teenager. But anyway, Rhonda, so I hope you don't mind me just pointing out a little bit of a difference there.
I know, but can I tell you another case that's similar to this one from last year that nobody heard about? This was in Florida. An African-American man, he wasn't parked right or something, so the police apprehended him. I think this was in Florida. He was scared. They were, you know, he probably, just like Ms. Park said, and he ran. The police got trapped in his car. They ran him over. He ran as fast as he could. He was unarmed. They literally ran him over and killed him. This happened last year in Florida. People don't hear about these things. It's such an outrage.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I read about that. Yeah, it's not like people don't hear about it. That was in the news.
In the video, and I don't know that police officer was charged with murder. It's just graceful. I mean, I can't even express to you how upset, you know, I mean, I'm sure you understand, but mm-hmm. That's all I have to say. And this has been going on for years. And it's just, you know, the idea that people don't know, I just don't excuse. We have every access in this country we've had for years to care and know about these things. People don't want to know. Now, hopefully, maybe something will change. I don't know. But it's going to take a whole lot of work. Okay, thank you.
And that's the difference between what I think you were saying and what Rhonda's saying, that there has been media coverage, but it didn't have legs. It didn't get picked up by the rest of the culture way it is now.
Do we respond to videos?
Yeah, we do.
I keep going back to that. It seems almost trite because everyone's used to seeing these videos, but this is very powerful, and it changes things. It influences, in this case, how the mayor of the city reacted, how the police chief reacted. It changed a story from a police officer in a struggle with a suspect to an officer charged with murder.
Right.
I mean, this is a different age we live in. So maybe for the white society, you know, they knew there was a problem, but they didn't acknowledge it or didn't acknowledge it at all. But now you can't. You can't step around it, right?
Right.
Because the video is right there. Jen in Baltimore, we'll go to you for your comment next. Hi.
I think him being charged with murder is not enough. There needs to be sustainable, actionable change with education of the officers, including that officers can't tell those who are stopped that they can't videotape. And there needs to be change on every level and not just charging with murder as a response. That's the last part of what needs to be happening.
Hmm. Well, you're right. There has to be education on both sides because actually people do have the right to videotape whenever you're in a public space. In Maryland, you actually have to tell the person, by the way, that they're being videotaped if they don't know it. But you're right. There has to be social change. And evidently, we read one report, Dan and I, that young officers don't mind so much. It's the older officers who see videotaping as an affront to their authority. And authority means that privacy really is I am able to control the space around me. And so there's an age difference. And so older officers have to be educated.
You know, there's a feeling that body cameras on police are going to help with all of this, you know, that there'll be accountability for the people the police have to confront in doing their jobs, the jobs most of us don't want to do, and that there'll be accountability for the behavior of the police officers because of these cameras. But, you know, having this the third party over there behind the chain link fence with a cell phone still provides a perspective that you may not get from these body cameras.
That appears more objective.
Yeah. So we'll see about that. We can take some more phone calls on this, but right now I wanted to turn to one of the other topics that Sherry wanted to talk today, just to at least get this topic started as well. Do you want to talk about the poverty story?
Well, yes, because there are people, including me, who have said that poverty is a type of violence too. And I mean, that sounds very nice, but now there's evidence about what happens with poverty. And this was a study that first, it's important to know, controlled for genetic markers, so that we're not talking about inheritance, that found that the brains of poor children were 6% smaller than middle class and more affluent children. And because they control for genetic markers, it seems to point to environmental factors, the air they breathe, the food they eat, whether or not they have play areas, the quality of the schools. The problem is, well, the good thing is that this can be reversed if you catch the child early enough. But obviously, if it doesn't get reversed early enough, then the brain becomes less elastic. And so I really wanted to talk about this because I see this as part of the whole, that there's a type of, that we think of poverty primarily as a personal problem. There's been this shift in the society from the great society more to, well, if you're having a hard time, is this really your issue, not mine? And I can live, as you just said, in blissful ignorance of the condition. My point was that as a society, one, we if we're just talking about nutrition, we produce enough calories, more than enough calories for everybody in the country to eat. So this is a structural problem. It's not because of scarcity, because we actually, the average family throws away up to a third of its food, if you think about how much you waste in your time. And to have children whose brains are smaller than average, meaning and it's the part of the brain that controls learning that is most affected, then poverty becomes, again, a social problem and a type of violence to children if we can prevent it. My larger point when I was saying, oh, I really want to talk about this, is that as a society, we can't afford to have that many people whose brains are smaller in ways that we can fix.
Not if we're going to be competitive in all those ways that people want us to be in terms of our economy and our job growth and industry and innovation and all that would lead us to the future.
It begins to explain a lot, right? When you look at countries in Scandinavia that don't have the poverty we have that are surging ahead of us.
Sherry's referencing a study, the largest of its kind, according to Nature, the magazine Nature, published on March 30th. This involves the imaging of the brains of 1,100 children, 1,099 children. This was conducted by neuroscientists at Children's Hospital LA and Columbia University Medical Center. And they, as Sherry says, they found that the brain size of children who were in poverty was 6% smaller in surface area. The children whose families made less than $25,000 a year, about 6% smaller in surface area than children whose families made $150,000 or more per year.
We always do causality the other way. Oh, they have more money because, you know, they're smarter, as opposed to the other way around. They appear smarter because they have more money.
Yeah. we're going to go back to the phone lines on our earlier topic here, but we can also talk about this, too. Just the other day on Sunday, or last week, I received an email from a reader of my column in The Sun who didn't like what I wrote about income inequality, doesn't like that I bring this up and that I point out that we have, 14.8 million children living in poverty in the United States.
It's growing.
And it's growing. It's grown. It grew during the recession, mm-hmm. and it's grown again, and it's not good. And this person was writing to say, why do you keep bringing this up? This is class warfare that you're generating, me as the writer of this column. And I don't think I'm doing that. This is just, I'm just reciting facts to you that we don't like to talk about. We do not like this topic. People on one side of the political spectrum are more apt to talk about it than on the other side. And the other side throws that red flag and charges you with class warfare when you bring up this, but this is a reality of this country, and I don't think people like to talk about it because we consider ourselves so exceptional.
Right.
And there's another study out on this. I'm glad people are studying this. 1 in 4 U.S. kids don't know where their next meal is coming from. Actually, down to that, don't know if they're going to eat supper tonight.
Well, and that's why it goes beyond nutrition, because the stress of not knowing where your next meal comes from comes from affects the brain as well. That chronic stress.
Yeah, they point that out in that study. Right. Yeah. 410-662-8780. We'll talk about the religious freedom laws, too, in this hour of Midday on Culture with Sherry Parks. But we'll go back to the topic we brought up at the start of the show regarding videos of police officers and this particular case in South Carolina. Tim is in Ellicott City, and our next caller. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hey, thanks, Dan. I guess my only point was just that when people sign up to go into law enforcement, there's an inherent risk with that job, and they need to be aware of that. And when they're instructing officers in the academies and all like that, they need to maybe stress that point, because it seems like they're protecting themselves in the line of duty rather than protecting the public. They're more afraid of their own life. And it's a similar mentality to serving your country abroad. You're, you know, risking your life for a greater good. And it seems that it's a little backwards with the domestic policy in a lot of different areas across the country, that it's pull the trigger first, pull the gun out first, rather than, you know, let the situation unfold. As I mean, it's a sad state of affairs when just because of the color of your skin as a male, you're afraid to reach in your pocket. You know, because it's just so hair trigger, you know, I don't want to get shot. Well, then don't be a police officer, because that's a risk of that job, you know. So that's really my only point,
right,
is that there could be a paradigm shift, mm-hmm, and maybe just stressing public service, because you're not serving the public when you preemptively shoot someone instead of investigate a crime or let it unfold before your eyes. You're being scared, and you know, that's not who I want protecting me.
Right. That's interesting.
And that seems to be indicated in this case, because he shot Walter Scott 8 times, 5 of which hit him. That sounds like somebody who's out of control. And we've heard stories before of the police seemed out of control. And I do think it's time to look again at who goes into police work. I mean, there should be certain aptitude tests. And I think they do some of that, and a certain level of training. This presumption that you get to have privacy as a police officer is bizarre to me, because you're a public figure. And the ability to handle stress and to shoot somebody maybe in their leg or their arm. But I don't think a 50-year-old man running away because he had a broken taillight would be the end of the world if he lost him.
Right.
So I think
if he jumped over a fence and he never saw him again.
Right. I mean, anyway, the world.
And he had his car, right?
Right.
He could have tracked him down. But
right.
There's all those things we're thinking about. But it didn't seem like it would be that hard to think of those things even in the moment, right?
If you had been trained to, yes.
If you've been trained
to.
But
that's the point.
Is that really asking a lot? Is a man running away from you? You've only stopped him for a traffic light, and maybe you didn't like the way he behaved with you, but still, really, you're going to draw your sidearm and do this? You know, speaking of this culturally, you know, all of us, black, white, brown, whoever we are, you can't live in a culture where we don't trust the police. This is broken.
It's broken.
This is deeply broken. And how do we get that back? How do we get, if we ever had it? I mean, one part of society had it, I guess, all the time. But I don't see how we can function if we don't trust people we're paying to protect us.
And you remember in Ferguson, one of the things they were calling for was to dismiss the police and hire new people.
And start all over again.
And start all over, and that hasn't happened. They were trying to address that.
Sherry Parks with us for another hour of Midday on Culture. Please join our conversation, 410-662-8780. We'll take a little break here. When we come back, we'll continue to talk about this latest police shooting, the one from South Carolina. I was sickened by what I saw, the police chief in North Charleston, Eddie Driggers, said at a press conference. We'll continue to talk about that, but also we'll get back to these freedom of religion laws in Indiana and Arkansas, the backlash to those, and also what's coming up in the Supreme Court later in this month. We'll fill you in. A short break. We'll be right there. Go back to the phone lines and take some more calls with Sherry Parks here on the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks in Studio A at WYPR. And Jim is calling us from Kingsville. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. A cross-cultural study. 8 years ago in Athens, Greece, there was a demonstration, and they do a lot of this, 5,000 to 10,000 people out there. An unarmed teenager was shot by the police Now, the word unarmed is not unusual in Greece because nobody's got guns except for rifles for hunting. So the police said that the boy was hit by a ricochet off of the pavement, one of three shots that were fired. This was so horrific to Europe, even more European-wide, that this is commemorated every year, this killing. 250 articles have been written from all over Europe. Now, the result of this, the autopsy showed that there was a straight shot into the boy. The result of this is that the partner of the police got 20 years, and the officer who shot the boy got life plus 100.
Wow. And your question is, why doesn't that happen in this country? And it's rare in this country that we even have a prosecution of a police officer. It was recommended after Ferguson and after the Garner case that independent prosecutors handle these cases of police-involved shootings. So there won't be so many questions raised about the connection between local district attorneys or state's attorneys and the police forces that they have to work with on a regular basis all the time. Bob in Moncton, we'll go to you next. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Excuse me. The one thing I wanted to add is I wouldn't necessarily guarantee that this case is over with and decided based on that video, only because, I saw the video in Staten Island where the guy got smothered by four or five cops, and I thought I saw a mugging, and yet there were no charges. Rodney King, you saw him on the ground getting beaten and kicked by five or six cops, and all those guys were acquitted. You cherry pick a jury, you make up some kind of a story, and you get the kind of people that want to give cops the benefit of the doubt. It's perfectly possible that when this is all over with, you do not see a murder charge stick with this guy.
Okay. Bob, I have my case in Baltimore, too, where I mentioned it one more time. Officer shot a man fleeing from him in a shop, an unarmed man fleeing from him in a shopping center. The officer testified that he thought the man was raising his arm or reaching into a pocket as he ran away from him. He shot him and killed him, and the jury acquitted him.
I think this is related to Dan's point about you can't live without trusting the police. In order to not trust the police, you have to dismantle part of your safety net. And I think there are people who will refuse to do that and will always side with
because
the police.
Because we have to. Because we believe. What do you mean?
Because
we've always believed that.
Because it's too dangerous to your being not to.
But that breaks down racially, doesn't it?
Oh, sure.
It's much different. Already is different for whites and blacks, right?
But if you feel you live in a society that is made safe by the police, and maybe those police are protecting you from those bad guys, mm-hmm. and those bad guys maybe are black, in a lot of people's perceptions they are. The black guys are the bad guys, and the cops are the good guys. You have to dismantle all of that attitude set in order to not side with the police, and that can be hard.
Mary in Towson, thank you for calling Midday.
Hi,
Mary. What'd you want to say?
I just a couple of things. I'm older, 72, grew up in Chicago, lived through whatever, the racial marches, read a bunch of books, not in my neighborhood here, mm-hmm. In Baltimore. And I don't know, we went to see 42, about Jackie Robinson, The Butler, and I'm embarrassed to be a white woman. It's not just about the police. I mean, which is horrific. I mean, it's terrible. Yes, you should be able to trust them, but yeah, I am. There's every day listening to this program, whatever it is, it's an embarrassment, and we should do something about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary.
Have a great day.
You too.
I love your program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Listen to YPR all day.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Mary.
I feel that for you. I think the most hopeful part of her statement is that we should do something about it. I do think this is a moment where white people are turning. I've always said that the decent white people should take the name white back, and I think that's got to happen. And we aren't talking about the racist phone calls and videos and emails, but notice what's happened in those cases is that white people are calling out other white people. Yeah. Those emails, black people wouldn't have seen. Those videos, black people wouldn't have seen. These are white people calling other white people. And I think that is, you know, the decent white people taking whiteness back.
Yeah. I got some comments on social media and an email about police officers feeling embarrassed by this, you know, that this sets them back, a case like this, because it's so outrageously wrong. You know,
and policemen can't do their work if somebody in the community doesn't trust them.
Right.
And I mean, it makes their lives harder, and it makes them targets. That's what happened in New York.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's not forget that.
Yeah.
Jen in Baltimore, thank you for calling Midday. You're up next. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, Jen, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to. First, I don't want to discount. I don't know 100% everything about the case that's happening in South Carolina. So this is sort of just a general comment, I guess. So my husband is a police officer in Baltimore City, and he's been for about 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think what unfortunately doesn't happen is police officers don't get heard. Nobody really sort of speaks up when an event like this happens to say what police officers have to go through. They do have to make quick decisions, and they're not looking out for themselves. They are thinking of the public. You had a caller a few minutes ago that said, you know, maybe there should be some review, that police officers are afraid. I will tell you right now that in Baltimore City, something kicks in and there is a camaraderie between them that they are protecting the public. They know a lot more about an individual sometimes than what the media portrays. I'm not going to speak specifically to what happened in South Carolina or Missouri, but, you know, when they stop a car, they do have a bit more information than what the media will lead on to say, well, they didn't know that this person was a good person, or, you know, that. Sometimes they do know that maybe in the past they've done some things that they do have to be on their guard. And if someone's running away from them, they have to respond. And they don't know if they're armed or if they're not armed. My husband personally was involved where somebody ran and he was chasing after them. And the man turned around when he was not more than 3 feet away, had a gun up his sleeve, and shot at him 3 times. So in that instance, my husband would tell you, I didn't know if he was armed or if he wasn't armed. I assumed he wasn't armed, and he was. So when you're, and that happens to him on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to remember that police officers are in these situations day after day after day after day, and there does need to be, you know, some more checks and balances, because it is a war zone, and just like soldiers are trained in the military to respond quickly, yes, police officers definitely have to make those decisions, and they're making them to protect the public. If there were no police officers, this would be like the Wild West here. It really would. And I'm not saying that, again, I'm not going to speak specifically to situations, but I do feel like the police should have a voice and that they should be recognized for what they do every day.
Okay.
And unfortunately, when
Jen,
situations like this happen.
Yep. I wondered about this too. You know, should we invite members of the Fraternal Order of Police on to talk about this? We should probably try to do that. But I wonder if they're extremely self-conscious of being in a position of you know, defending this kind of behavior out there, this excessive behavior. So I don't know whether they would do that or not. We haven't heard from a lot of them. So maybe we should try to do that.
I witnessed a town meeting with the police chief at the University of Maryland campus. And, you know, of course, I work there. And someone said police should have more degrees, and he's got 3. He's got a PhD. And he was very honest and very forthright and explained from his perspective what's going on. I do have to respond to some things that Jen said, and I'll try to do it really fast. I don't doubt that the daily life of a policeman is really hard and that they have to make real decisions. I think I am very disturbed by the term war zone and Wild West, which is itself a racist statement, that's the attitude. I think everybody is innocent until found guilty, and to say that the police know things about people is a way of disparaging the unarmed black man, that they must have been bad.
Thank you, Sherry. I wanted to just move on and touch briefly on this other story. Only because it's going to be newsy this month. The Supreme Court's going to hear arguments over same-sex marriage. We should expect this. April 28th, as a matter of fact, four cases will be before the court to deal with marriage bans, same-sex marriage bans in Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky, and Tennessee. I only mention that because it gives a little bit of context to the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act that came through in Indiana that was controversial. And Arkansas, people saw these as discriminating against gay and lesbian couples and marriage. So anyway, what did you make of the backlash? I was impressed, almost stunned by the backlash to the enactment of these two laws and the governor signing them.
Well, what has happened is that now 59% of Americans believe that gay and lesbian people should have the same rights as everybody else. That's what's happened. Now we're in the consensus mode, and large corporations, even those that have been perceived as being pretty conservative, cannot afford. I mean, there were cities already calling for boycotts. And so you just can't afford that. So that's part of what's going on. It's interesting because it's colliding constitutional rights. I mean, you have religious freedom. Mm-hmm. I think it hinges on what you mean by practicing religion, whether that means the worship or whether you get to practice your religion wherever you are, which is one interpretation, versus the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness if you happen to be gay. And I think it's going to be interesting what they do.
So that social change that you noted earlier in the show, you think this is taking place with our view toward police conduct, right?
Yes, I think it. Yeah, I think we're in the earlier stages of that.
And we're more advanced when it comes to gay rights. Yes. Therefore, this backlash.
This backlash, okay. Which wouldn't have happened 10, 15 years ago.
Let's take another call. Let's try to slip in one more call. Nancy called from West Virginia to say something about the South Carolina case. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, hope you're having a good day. I called because I really want to put a little focus on the kudos for the young man or person who took the video and
yes.
made it public.
Yes.
You know, it really is very difficult to do the right thing when you feel your life could be at risk or you could be persecuted in some other way, and we need good people to stand up and do the right things, and I'm very impressed with that. The other quick comment I wanted to make is that we talk about perhaps a police officer was frightened, and I think we also need to look at maybe it wasn't fear. Maybe it's a bias that they have that they grew up with, and we don't see the same things happen in the same proportion to white men.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to recognize that.
Thank you, Nancy.
It was interesting in the documentary that I cited. He also has these scenes where the police are engaging with white men, and one who's holding an AK-47, the police walks up and sits down with him, and another who kicks the policeman in the groin, and they wrestle him to the ground, and then they talk to him. And so I realized that I had internalized the moment at which the black man would have been shot, so that I'm
expecting that?
I'm expecting that, even though intellectually, I know it's not likely to happen. My body is ready for it. And there is, and statistically, there's a difference.
That documentary Sherry Parks mentioned is Hands Up, Don't Shoot.
My Youth Movement.
And how did you find that? Did you see that?
We brought him to the University of Maryland. He's touring around.
The filmmaker.
The filmmaker, Ralph Crowder.
I have to look for that. Hands Up, Don't Shoot, the Youth Movement.
Yes, right. My Youth Movement.
My Youth Movement.
Our youth movement.
Thank you, Sherry. Sherry Parks is Associate Dean in Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park and joins us from time to time to talk about American culture. Thank you very much for joining this conversation.
Sure, happy to be
leading
here.
This conversation, Sherry. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, who contributed to Midday today. Hope you enjoy the program. Come back for more. Please tell your friends about it. We're here every Monday through Friday, noon to 2. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great afternoon and see you soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Alexis Kuhn, Aaron Morenzi, and Mary Troutman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.